This is a production of Cornell University.
So, scope of the problem with student housing is we've got deferred think it should really be in that on-campus envelope, as you see bracketed, but more options on the table at that point, whether they stay up on North, whether they move into a West Campus house system, a co-op, a sorority, a fraternity, stay in a program house, et cetera, et cetera. Still in an on-campus envelope, but again, more options. But then looking generally at the third and fourth years as the off-campus years. Not exclusively. We have just under 1,200 juniors and seniors who live on campus with us today, and we would like to maintain that at a steady state. But in general, first 2 years we really see as kind of our responsibility to be on campus and provide that experience for students. Second 2 years, not as much. That's when they start to integrate into the community as is appropriate for them. And I'll talk a little bit more. So we identified these three key problems, and Mike alluded to these, so I won't spend a lot of time. We have very significant deferred maintenance backlog within the housing portfolio alone. Within the housing portfolio alone, that backlog is about $150 million. These four facilities that are listed on the screen represent about two-thirds of that $150 million. So they're our top priorities in terms of addressing the deferred maintenance. So we have two issues to solve there. A, we've got to come up with capital to fix and put money into these facilities. But B, and the thing that Mike mentioned here, if I wanted to do any of these today, even if I had the money, I couldn't, because we're so full, we do not have any excess space on campus for us to shut down Balch, which is 430-some students. They would have nowhere to go. We'd essentially be telling 430 students, good luck, go find space somewhere else in Ithaca. And we know that's not realistic either. So before we can even tap into this, even money issues aside, we have to have more on-campus capacity for this space. We have to address the deferred maintenance in this plan. We also know that a significant number of our current students would like to live on campus, many more so than we can accommodate. So when we asked students this question last spring when we were surveying them, a lot more said they much prefer to be on campus if they could make that happen, and we just don't have that capacity right now. Some of the other elements that I talked about here, getting first-year students out of townhouses, some of our residence halls, we do maximize the space is the term that we use when we take what used to be a double and make it a triple, those kinds of things, and those stories get passed down over generations. Hey, this used to be a closet when I lived here or when I lived here. We don't like to hear those. And so we want a little more flexibility in the system as well. And this just gives you a sense of our current capacity, or our current where we're at, our occupancy. So effectively what we're talking about here is really trying to take this sophomore bar, the light shade one, and move it as far right as possible. Our ambition would be that it's all the way right, just like the first year bar. That all first and second year students live in this campus envelope. Remember, that includes a pretty broad, and then we keep a steady space for juniors and seniors. To do that, just to get the bar right, in today's world, we need to add about 1,450 beds. And that would save us now. We also want to think about future growth. So Cornell's grown over the years. The provost is engaged in a conversation. Part of what he's going to be talking about is how will we grow in the future. He's trying to take a very strategic look at this and set targets around that so that it's not a creep, per se, but being really mindful of that. And we want to make sure that within the housing portfolio, we can support that academic mission of the institution should there be growth and should that final determination be what that might look like, where it is. So we want to be able to meet that growth without exacerbating the current conditions. So you take that 1,450 in there, and then you add whatever growth might build on to get us an end, basically, of where we need to go to in order to really change the residential game on this campus. So when we looked at where we could do this, and this comes back around with one of those programmatic elements, this represents the campus of this campus. You see some of the criteria we were looking at. I won't read all those. The blue shaded boxes really are kind of the primary development type that we could most easily, quickly, and affordably build without disrupting a lot of campus or requiring a lot of advanced site work and money and infrastructure and all those types of things. The orange shaded areas all come with a little bit more baggage in terms of what it would take to prepare those sites or navigate. Many of them on West Campus, for instance, either have really difficult topographical issues, or they are adjacent to historical districts or in historical districts, which just adds a whole layer of complexity when you think about future development. So all this really does is start to point us up to North Campus as our most developable space. Now, some of you who are paying attention to the university's capital planning process will point out, appropriately, that this area more dining. We think we could accommodate about 400 more students in our current dining capacity before we would have to grow. So, you know, this is a full implementation we absolutely need. At a 2,000 bed or so, we absolutely need more dining. So that will depend, obviously, on where we finally land when we get into the how here. But this is the concept map if we were to do this full build-out and realize this goal of this ambition of being able to house all first-year, all second-year students on campus. This is how that might play out.
So I'll try and go quickly so we have time for questions. I want to lay out the second side of this, which is Ryan referred to, and that is the more students part of this. There is an academic case right now for having more freshman students on the campus, and that case is made virtually every day by every dean. Virtually every dean has requested, every undergraduate dean has requested more freshmen from the provost, and they don't care where they get them. Right now we're in a zero-sum game, and we're limited by the number of beds. But I show here, if I point you to this column, you see that in FY08, we spent about $80 million a year from our operating budget on financial aid. We now spend almost $200 million. So about $120 million more from our operating budget is going for financial aid. That was the impact of some very courageous decisions on the part of David Gordon to really increase the access of Cornell to students without means, and to get us into the Ivy League, if you will, in terms of our financial aid policy. Having done that, that created a lot of the financial stresses that I'm talking about, and has created a lot of constraints on our budget that you have felt and I have felt. And you see here, I'll skip through this. We're in particularly, Cornell is a far greater proportion of our financial aid comes from our operating budget because we have more students than our other Ivy cohorts, and because we have less endowment than those other Ivy League universities. So how do we frame the solution given that financial reality? There is no path to solving this problem. That is the academic investment problem and the housing problem and the academic facilities problem through our normal processes. That is, no combination of increases in tuition, reasonable modifications of financial aid, or cost constraints on the university will provide us with the capital that we need or the funding that we need on an operating basis for academic investment. So my principles here have been, we need a responsible and creative solution that balances these objectives. It doesn't solve one problem on the back of another. So the fundamental principles are, don't sacrifice one type of investment for another. In other words, invest in academics and let our buildings go to hell. Or conversely, you know, fix our buildings but constrain the budgets of our colleges more. Don't predicate building projects on philanthropy, because we've been there before, and building projects for new dorms are not a great sale for philanthropy, and we just have to be realistic and not burden the future and push this down the road. And then, so we have to have a solid revenue plan for any commitments that we make. Now, pushed us to try and solve this problem as quickly as we can. We would, part of that would be swing space, so we'd renovate Balsh's part of it. And also, we're having conversations. You see a lot of change in College Town. We're having conversations with those individuals about how do we create a better environment for our students in College Town and to make sure there's capacity in College Town to address the more students we're adding to this equation, and hopefully provide a better and safer and more affordable environment for those students. So, the academic case, why is increasing freshman pay? First of all, it provides funds and addresses, but the academic case is arts and sciences now is at the highest faculty to student ratio that they've been in decades. That's because they did not participate in the growth in transfer students as other colleges did, but they increased their faculty, and more of the students that go into arts also take courses in CIS. My son was an arts student who majored in CIS. So they're taking less courses within arts, business, CIS, medicine, etc., and that provided arts with a capacity. Biomedical engineering has a new department, new faculty, new graduate students, but no new freshmen. They have a desire, they're pulling from other majors in engineering. We have the College of Business that wants to grow, that wants to be of a similar size, or they're far less, but of a size that is closer to their competitors in other business schools. Cal needs more students. They need particularly a backfill of students to replace the Dyson students whose tuition revenue now goes to the College of Business. So all of these are academic reasons why deans are asking for more students. And fundamentally, I would say there's one other reason, and that is Cornell is not and has never been a Caltech or a Princeton. We're not about having the smallest possible, most elite class size and the largest endowment per student body. We have been any student, any study, and providing more access for students, and we have a tremendous, again, our early admissions applications this year we saw are up again. We have a tremendous demand for this education, and a modest increase seems appropriate given our mission. So, again, each college has requested more. I've gone through the this biomedical engineering, college of business growth, Cal, etc. What are the potential downsides? One significant downside is if we do this and degrade the student experience. We add more students and we don't fix the problems but exacerbate them. That's an implementation risk that is on me. So we have 2 years before we would increase the class size at all. And during that period of time, we have to focus on addressing this and making sure we get ready. Secondly, I hear a lot from trustees and others around the U.S. News and World Report rankings. Much of those rankings are expenditures per student. Our denominator would grow, and so we would have a challenge on our U.S. News and World Report rankings. There's ways to mitigate this. We're undertaking a comprehensive look at the data that we put in U.S. News and World Report. We have not focused on that data in the past, thinking about how we represent the institution appropriately. I think there's some opportunities there. This does not have to, I think much of this can be mitigated, but it is certainly a risk. Our debt capacity is another risk that trustees point out around our capacity to take more debt, and whether this affects our bond rating, which did slip a little bit after 2008. We still have more capacity before we get downgraded, but given the fact Beth is Isle Tyner. I talked to Martha about this quite a bit. She's very much in favor of this plan. We've had numerous meetings with trustees, faculty senate, provost staff committee, vice president, deans. All the deans are in alignment with this plan. And we had a 2.5-hour discussion with the Board of Trustees in a joint meeting of finance and executive, and that was in September, and then October and November, I got poked in the eye with a sharp stick again. We had a 3-hour meeting with combined executive committee, finance committee, buildings and properties, student life, and academic affairs. And we all unbelievably came out of that with a consensus, unanimous consensus, actually, to go forward and try and solve these problems in this manner. Now, the how is not completely determined. Whether we borrow it, whether we do it in partnership, whether we use somebody else's equity, all of that we're going to be exploring over the next several months. But the what is new, there is significant agreement. And I presented to the assembly, as you can see there, Ryan and I have together. So again, the overall idea here is an academic solution and a capital solution that will try, I think, significantly improve the student experience for Cornell freshmen who currently come to Cornell and within weeks of arriving here start looking for apartments in College Town because they don't know if they're going to have Cornell as space for them on their campus in their second year. And then we are coupling this, when Martha arrives, when President Pollack arrives, we're coupling this with the faculty initiative around faculty, trying to point our philanthropy and our communication strategy towards this academic investment and solving the student housing project, but we're focusing the philanthropy part on our faculty. So with that, next steps, this is, again, a little bit of a dated plan, but we'll, in January, ask for the school board to acknowledge and not technically approve because we don't know the how yet, but to endorse the overall solution of this and then initiate the capital plan and then kick off the campaign. So I'll skip this for
at this time, I'll open up the speakers list, so anybody who has questions, not only the assembly members, but also the audience members, so Hazel and then we'll move to Angel.
You talked about renovating Balch. That's a one-gender building. The low-rises are really sad, and that's where they're putting all the triples. So I was wondering, what's the future for the low-rises?
Sure. So we talked a lot and we assessed all the different facilities. Of course, you know them really well. The ones that we put on the list are the ones that have the greatest infrastructure issues, that we're worried about whether they can stay open. Some of the other buildings, like the low-rises, cosmetically and aesthetically are sad, I think was the word you used. But
yeah,
from an infrastructure perspective, they're in a lot better shape than Balch, than the Gothic, some of those types of things, where we're just really worried about the mechanicals failing, about the very basic fundamentals. So the low rises and the high rises, some of those are not in this first phase. There's a slide I've been sharing pretty broadly, too, that identify those as kind of the next step after that we're going to have to address those facilities as well. But we put on our list the things that have the greatest infrastructure issues that we need to address.
Okay, and the second part of my question, then I'll pass it to Angel. You talked about looking at staffing, et cetera. I can't seem to make people understand that if you add triples to a building, you're going to have more people using the restrooms, you're going to have more people in lounges, you're going to have more people using the stairwells, and I still have the same amount of staff in those buildings. I can't make people understand that if you're going to increase staff, you're going to have to increase students, you're going to have to increase staff to allow my staff to keep to the standards that my service agreement has. So
let me just say, so we have a financial behind this for the new students, which is, I think, so if we do add new students, we're going to add new faculty, we're going to add new staff, we've got to have more TAs. So that's taken into account in the financial model. We're not saying, I tell there's an anecdote, I did a little experiment when I first became provost because I knew Kent had been hearing all this, I want more students, and I immediately got, you know, Kent promised me I need this. And I said, okay, I asked every dean to tell me how many students they could accommodate with no new staff and no new faculty. Now that's not student campus life, but that's the dean. And the number was 657. So an enormous amount. We're going to increase staff, we're going to appropriately do this, but I could just give you a sense of the demand.
Thank you.
Angel, please introduce yourself for the record.
Yeah, so I'm Montana Carkeen, or Angel, and I work for Diversity Programs Engineering. I'm assistant director. So, I mean, it's really great put together, but at the same time, like, it really raises, as an advisor, and I used to work in med life too, like, I don't know if necessarily adding students could be the answer to, like, the financial issues, because as it is currently in both sides, there's staff positions that have either been added on to someone else currently or have just disappeared and the duties were just spread out. And so staff, and because there's a plan for faculty, but for staff, like professional development has been taken away. Mm-hmm. And so like you have people staying in the same position for long periods of time because they just don't get the development they need so that they can go and move up. I myself have been here for 4.5 years. And then my other thing is like staff of color as well, like retaining them. And so, like, I've been here. There's only 4 of us left that came in 4.5 years ago. And I'm the only woman. And I identify as Latina. I'm the only woman that's still here. And so, like, that's the other thing is, like, yes, you want to add more students, but what about the well-being of staff and not being overwhelmed? I know a lot of people that take mental health leave because they're so overwhelmed in their jobs. Like, I know that the survey for staff, whether they like working here or not, is coming out soon. But, like, also the answer is the Hurtado report came out several years ago, and there was significant dissatisfaction among students here. There's already, like, if you look just in engineering advising, they manage freshmen and sophomores. That's, like, 1,400 students for 4 advisors. Yes. Like, how much of an impact does that really make? And, like, and then you're going to increase numbers, so that means also the number of URMs and first-gen and low-income students are going to come in, too. Like as it is, like diversity offices are already very low staff, or there's openings that still haven't been filled. So like, although this would may solve future problems, what about the problems that are going on here right now?
The thing I would say is just to ask you to understand that those problems that you articulate are real problems. I could state other problems on the academic side that departments are talking about faculty positions that aren't filled, et cetera. Those are a manifestation of where we are now and the stresses that we've come through budget-wise over the last 4 or 5 years. Doing nothing doesn't solve those problems. What I'm suggesting is a solution that provides revenue that will allow us to have the flexibility to address those problems. So some of that revenue is dedicated in the model towards addressing the staffing and advising issues that you're referring to. That's part of our thinking about this. But I ask you to distinguish between what our existing condition and existing difficult condition, which are not going to be resolved. I don't have the resources to be able to address these if we don't do so.
Because then if you also add more housing for students, and let's say you can't have staff, the other question is where? Like, because as it is, like, for offices and space, like, even if you add more staff, like, where are they going to go? Like, where are they going to be placed? Where is their office going to be? So, like, even though adding housing, that will add more students,
yeah.
But then on the academic side, to accommodate the staff space, where is that going to happen?
So we have capacity on the academic side. What we have is a lot of space that has not been adequately invested in. we've already built lots of buildings. And we're paying off the debt for those. We haven't invested in the buildings that we have, and so that's caused part of this issue that I think I'm hearing you refer to. But I don't think the answer is you're suggesting we need to build more academic space for more staff. That's not my understanding. That adding staff is limited by our current capacity.
Okay. So we have one more person on the speaker's list, and then we'll have to move on to the next thing, Jeremy.
Sure. Answer my question.
Oh, great. But Carrie?
I just wondered whether this would dovetail at all with any sort of investment in parking. I mean, if you're adding more bodies to campus, I think we already see a lot of stress from, within the staff rank. Finding parking in a reasonable amount of time at an affordable cost, especially, and I'm a representative for University Relations, and there's a large part of our staff that is based in College Town.
Mm-hmm.
We have development there that, with residential development happening that's not coupled with additional parking. And so we have now this influx of people that are all sort of competing over the same spot.
Yeah. So I know it's right there to park in College Town.
Right.
I've tried that.
So
North Campus, we're going to have to solve the parking issue. Are you talking about on-campus parking or mainly College Town and these areas around?
Well, we had a transportation forum a little earlier in the semester where they implied they're looking to push parking out of Central Campus, and we have, College Town is obviously an issue.
Yeah.
But just in general, more bodies on campus
is going to
put some additional stuff.
Well, so let me say a couple things about College Town first, because I do think that's a significant issue. And then let me just give you the big picture of what I think the thinking of it is. We have a lot of course, existing buildings in College Town where they're not sprinklers. Whether they're code or, whether they're grandfathered into overcode is an issue. Not much investment in the buildings. I think everybody would acknowledge that. High rent. And I hear this from parents and students, and my son lives in a little sort of a foyer for $1,000
So thank you both so much for coming today. If anybody else has other questions that they did not get to answer, please feel free to send them directly to me or directly to the provost, and Ryan for that matter. You both are happy to receive them, but we can compile them all in one if you send them directly to me and get answers to you all. Thanks so much for coming.
Thank you.
And we'll take your flat. We'll bring you your flash drive to your office, or do you want to grab it? No. Yeah. Yeah. My. So I get all the university secrets. great. Okay. That's fine. So we're going to move on to resolution 4 as lunch comes into the room. It's actually to make the transition. Resolution 4 commitment to Cornell commitment to web accessibility. This was introduced. We are only going to spend a few minutes on this. Yes, I think we can. Why don't you present, and I will put this on the thing.
So, start with your motion to them.
Sure. Once again, I'm bringing up Cornell Commitment to Web Accessibility, Resolution 4. I have been in quite a lot of meetings over this resolution since it started. It turned into a much bigger project than I had anticipated, which is awesome. It's wonderful. I've been able to sit down and talk with CIP, Student Disability Services, ADA Coordinators Team, University Communications Office, Department of Inclusion, Workforce Diversity, Student Academic Services, as well as individual students, faculty, and staff members who've approached me and we've had discussions of this. And one of the things that I've learned in doing this, and I've learned a lot in doing this, is that there isn't anybody that's opposed to this. There is no one opposed to the idea of what we're trying to accomplish. They're in favor of increased accessibility to the Cornell digital resources because it really does fit our values. The only differences that really have been how to accomplish that. How do we get to that objective? And some of the concerns that were brought up, there's an idea that we should gather all of the resources that we need prior to setting the policy so that we have those resources available to make the policy successful. My response to that is that I think we should be setting the policy as a goal to achieve. Set the goals and use it to inform the progress and assess the resources that we need to continually achieve that as we go. I don't think this is something that we're going to gather the resources, spend it, and solve it. That's not what we're talking about. This isn't going to be solved overnight. What we're looking at is, I don't even expect that if this were to pass and there was CLEDA policy exactly as this is written, which is unlikely, that we would see any majority of conformance even in the next 5 years. So this is a goal and a progressive change that's going to need to be reevaluated on a regular basis, including resources. And I think this is a really good place to start. The other thing that was brought up is that we should set guidelines rather than policy until we're closer to actually being able to achieve any goals. Only set policy when most of us can reach as requirements. And that way no one needs to be specifically tagged as you are responsible for this. And my feeling is that we need to be very firm and clear about what our goals are, where we want to be as a university, that we need to start making progress towards accessibility as a slow iterative change over the next several years. We don't need to achieve it tomorrow or even next year, but we need to start progressing in the right direction, and I think a policy with some firm goals is the way to do that. We've all agreed that we need to move towards greater accessibility, and I think that's the direction we need to start heading. A policy is a stronger way to set these goals,
So there's been a motion to amend on the floor. The amendment reads as follows. Be it further resolved, Cornell Administration, in consultation with the Department of Inclusion and Workforce Diversity, the ADA Coordinator Team, the Divisions of University Relations and Cornell Information Technologies, and Cornell Information Technologies, will name and or identify an office person or persons as a point of contact on campus to handle reporting, assist with procedures, and periodically assess the resources needed to ensure successful implementation of the policy. Is there a second to this amendment? There's been a second. Is there any dissent? Well, actually, it doesn't matter. Once it's been seconded, it's on the floor. So now the amendment is up for discussion. Any motions on the amendment or points of discussion? Seeing none, I will call the amendment to question. Is there a second? It's been seconded. All those in favor of approving the amendment so that it will be considered in the whole resolution, please raise your placard. All those who oppose to the amendment. All those who abstain. By a vote of 14-0, the amendment passes. We are back into discussion on the resolution as a whole. So it's what you have in front of you with this addition in it at this point in time. Motions, points of discussion. Yeah, I'll add briefly, that's an interesting point. There's been this chicken or the egg conversation of if we don't create a climate that's inclusive, people aren't going to voluntarily self-identify. So really the only data that's out there are the number of students who've registered with Student Disability Services or the number of folks, whether they be staff, faculty, or students, who have voluntarily self-identified either through the employment process or in a climate survey that has gone out.
Goal, I think it would be really important to have some
that, you'll be seeing another resolution.
So noting that we only allotted 10 minutes to this and we're a little behind schedule, either we motion to table this until the next meeting or you call it to question or some other motion at this point in time. The general group. There's been a motion to vote to call the resolution to question. Is there a second? It is not. Oh, there's a second. Yep. It has been seconded. Is there any dissent? Seeing none, we will vote on resolution 4. All those in favor of resolution 4, raise your placard or your hand in this point. Yes. All those who are opposed. All those who abstain. By a vote of 15-0-0, the resolution passes. Thank you, and so we'll communicate this to the president. Next item on the agenda, I think you're up again, actually. Next item on the agenda is Resolution 5, endorsing the Ithaca Plan, a public health and safety approach to drugs and drug policy. This has been on the agenda for about a month and a half, 2 months now at this point. So you've had plenty of time to review, so that's why we only dedicated 5 minutes to this. So brief introduction.
I believe we heard the mayor speak on this.
That was the UA. The UA.
So the brief introduction to this, and I'm going to make this really brief, is the whole purpose behind this is decreasing the focus on criminalizing drug addiction and increasing the focus on making it a medical issue that needs to be addressed. So that's bottom line, what we're trying to achieve with this. And I hope you've all had a chance to review the policy. I think that we're definitely moving in the right direction with it. I think that America is really being progressive and taking a lead and setting an example with this. So I very much support this.
First up, Laura.
There was
Tina?
I have a different question altogether.
Okay,
that's fine. We're pressed for time, and I have a feeling we're going to table this for a broader discussion.
I think that's a good idea.
Go ahead.
On the first resolve clause, line 73, it calls for the Ithaca plan to be advocating for the approval of the Ithaca plan in the upcoming 2017 legislative session. Are you talking about state or federal?
This would be state. To my understanding, it's state. This goes to the New York State Legislature.
Not federal.
Not federal. So food for thought to the sponsors to add state when you come back next to line 73. To clarify between state and federal legislative session. That's, yeah, another point. Or just like, short and sweet. So seeing that there clearly is additional discussion that needs to happen on this, I'm going to move to table this resolution until either our next, we'll say our next meeting, but it might be the meeting after that, considering what we have to do, and we'll do our best to, I know the mayor came to the UA meeting to explain all of this and had a pretty in-depth discussion. We'll see if he can do the same to come to this body and see if some of the other folks who were actually at Cornell that sat on the committee that put this together can also join. So are we okay with that motion? Perfect. Great. All right, great. So we are going to move on to R7. I was like, I'm missing a number. To R7, LGBTQ. Oh, this is me. LGBTQ inclusion and university benefits. We're not going to spend too much time on this either. Jeremy, this is actually going to need you because I'm going to have to step down as chair. So
okay.
To sponsor this resolution. So I'm going to step down and very briefly go over this once again. In kind of layman's terms, what we're asking for in the resolve clauses is not, there's no action necessarily on the part of the institution thus far to do anything aside from a simple assessment of current benefits. This is essentially a request for information from the assembly. To our lovely colleagues here in human resources, and by the way, Gordon, did you want to introduce yourself? So what we're asking essentially from Gordon's new office is to see what benefits that are currently offered both on the state side, if we can get that in a timely fashion, and the endowed side that are gendered in nature, and whether they have to be that way or not, and if there is some leeway to change them. This has come up in conversations specifically with the LGBT colleague network group. Particularly a lot of same-gender couples who are not able to take advantage of some of the family planning benefits because of particular limitations around gender. So, you know, those in some instances, a fertility treatment is being covered, and whether or not you can apply those fertility treatments, and typically those are only available to women. And so a same-sex gender couple would not necessarily, or a same male couple would not be able to take advantage of that. So there is some difficulty there. So we're just trying to get an assessment of what's out there, get a lay of the land first, no action on our part being taken now. Michelle? Right. Well, then that's another conversation because that's illegal in New York State. So but essentially.
I'm wondering what the other options are that.
Right. So essentially, if a same-sex male couple did want to apply a fertility treatment to, let's say, you have a sister or a very close friend who would be willing to carry or something like, who would be willing to do the surrogate, they can't do that. That's the issue. And there's also a question of whether or not, you know, there should be some sort of compensation or some sort of adjustment in the adoption benefit that would kind of offset that just to make this somehow a bit more equitable. So we don't know what any of the solutions are at this point. That's why we just want to see get a complete lay of the land. We only want to see what the actual benefits are that are gendered or not. And while this is, yes, something that is directed and that came up from the LGBT community, it overall is really just to make this equitable across genders. It has, it's not just specifically for the queer community. So. So it says they should make a good faith effort. So there are some things that I know have been in discussion for a long time, that if there was something that was very easy to correct that wouldn't necessarily require any action on our part, mm-hmm. by all means, go ahead and do it if that's what you all see fit, which is why we say you all should normatively make a good faith effort to do something, and if you do something, include it in the report so we know that something happened and that there was a change. I'll call questions.
Second.
Second. Any opposed? Seeing none.
Take a vote.
All those in favor?
You.
We got one behind you, too.
And abstention. By the vote of 17 of my count. Somebody else get the difference? 17-0-0.
You're the chair. I'm sorry.
The resolution passed.
Fantastic. Thank you. Seize your power. No, I'm kidding. In the last couple minutes that we're going to do, we are going to allow for introduction of Resolution 8 in support of making Cornell a sanctuary campus. I'm sorry?
Connected to the box, right?
Yes.
Okay. I didn't think it was printed.
It's not printed?
No.
Oh, I'm sorry. I was like, I thought it was printed. No, their copy is actually now.
Okay. The only thing that we did and we will be changing is after the whereas in line 40-41, you will be adding another whereas stating the University Assembly has passed their resolution to defend Cornell University of San Jose campus on December 16th. And it will continue as written here, be it therefore resolved. For the employee assembly, you are seeing the sentiment. And in line 46, what we're looking for mainly is be it further resolved that the employee assembly calls for Cornell administration's name and or identify persons who are office point of contact on campus that would assist with DACA policies, procedures, resources to better assist staff in providing support to DACA students at Cornell University. That was my main goal.
Mm-hmm. Did you want to speak on that briefly?
Yeah. So as you all know, obviously, I wanted to bring this into the perspective of employees and staff, regular employees and regular staff. Most employees are not handling or aware of and dealing with immigration or visa concerns. Therefore, you probably don't even know that you may have an undocumented student with you. You may not even know that there is one of these student employees working off of an employment authorization document
not giving time to run around and having to go to all these multiple places, but timely support.
Any questions on the documentation that we sent in today in the email, as far as the general points of view with Sanctuary Campuses, what Cornell has done, written by our faculty?
Gina?
I just wonder, are there any staff members who are DACA, who are not students here on the visa, student visa, but that are undocumented staff members that Cornell hire?
Within human resources, obviously, when we hire regular staff, most regular staff positions are not visa sponsored anyway, so an individual would have to show proof of legal authorization to work and provide those documentation to their I-9. That would be checked by the human resources rep. Therefore, if you don't provide those proofs, regardless of whichever documentation you provide, you wouldn't be employed. Student employees that are given tasks may be showing one of those documents that are given to them because they are a doctor. So in theory, they could be an employee, but yet they would most likely be a student as well.
Thank you.
Other questions? Yep.
I support the idea of a campus resource, but the resolution
So we've expired our meeting time, but this is actually something that will, this is only for introduction, so I encourage anyone who has questions, comments, other points of discussion to connect with your constituent groups and farm this out, to connect with the sponsors of the resolution and ask those questions, and if there are any amendments, come to the next meeting kind of prepared to make those such amendments, okay? All right, so with that, is there a motion to adjourn? There's been a motion to adjourn. Is it seconded? There better not be any dissent. just kidding. With that, meeting is adjourned. Please do enjoy your holidays and the breaks. I know we all need a vacation right now. Food for thought. Well, one. Speaking of food, please get some lunch. It was a little delayed. Sorry. Yeah. Sorry about it. But please get some. When we come back on the 4th, we will have Linda Crow Howell join us and Michelle Arterby to talk about retiree representation on the EA. Linda will be back the following meeting to talk about, to give you kind of a primer to HR analytics and kind of how we will be going about partnering and assessing the results of the staff survey. And then following that at the first meeting in February, Marin Clarkberg will actually be here to present the results of the staff survey to all of us. And remember, we will be using that to create our strategic plan for staff going forward. So please be prepared, get all the rest you can because we have a full semester ahead of us. So thanks so much.
Thank you.
This has been a production of Cornell University on the web at cornell.edu.